ISIS Audiobooks presents an unabridged recording of Only Time Will Tell, written by Jeffrey Archer and read by Roger Allam and Amelia Fox. The moral right of the author has been asserted. This performance is owned by ISIS Publishing Limited.
Maisie Clifton, 1919. Prelude. This story would never have been written if I hadn't become pregnant. Mind you, I'd always planned to lose my virginity on the works outing to Weston-super-Mare, just not to that particular man. Arthur Clifton was born in Stillhouse Lane, just like me, even went to the same school, Merriwood Elementary. But as I was 2 years younger than him, he didn't know I existed. All the girls in my class had a crush on him, and not just because he captained the school football team. Although Arthur had never shown any interest in me while I was at school, that changed soon after he'd returned from the Western Front. I'm not even sure he realised who I was when he asked me for a dance that Saturday night at the Palais, but to be fair, I had to look twice before I recognised him, because he'd grown a pencil moustache and had his hair slicked back like Ronald Coleman. He didn't look at another girl that night, and after we danced the last waltz, I knew it would only be a matter of time before he asked me to marry him. Arthur held my hand as we walked back home, and when we reached my front door, he tried to kiss me. I turned away. After all, the Reverend Watts had told me often enough that I had to stay pure until the day I was married, and Miss Monday, our choir mistress, warned me that men only wanted one thing, and once they got it, they quickly lost interest. I often wondered if Miss Monday spoke from experience. The following Saturday, Arthur invited me to the Flicks to see Lillian Gish in Broken Blossoms, and although I allowed him to put an arm around my shoulder, I still didn't let him kiss me. He didn't make a fuss. Truth is, Arthur was rather shy. The next Saturday, I did allow him to kiss me, but when he tried to put a hand inside my blouse, I pushed him away. In fact, I didn't let him do that until he'd proposed, bought a ring, and the Reverend Watts had read the banns a second time. My brother Stan told me that I was the last known virgin on our side of the River Avon, though I suspect most of his conquests were in his mind. Still, I decided the time had come, and when better than the works outing to Weston-super-Mare with the man I was going to marry in a few weeks' time. However, as soon as Arthur and Stan got off the charabanc, they headed straight for the nearest pub. But I'd spent the past month planning for this moment, so when I got off the coach, like a good girl guide, I was prepared. I was walking towards the pier, feeling pretty fed up, when I became aware someone was following me. I looked around, and was surprised when I saw who it was. He caught up with me and asked if I was on my own. "Yes," I said, aware that by now Arthur would be on his third pint. When he put a hand on my bum, I should have slapped his face, but for several reasons I didn't. To start with, I thought about the advantages of having sex with someone I wasn't likely to come across again, and I have to admit, I was flattered by his advances. By the time Arthur and Stan would have been downing their eighth pints, he'd booked us into a guest house just off the seafront. They seemed to have a special rate for visitors who had no plans to spend the night. He started kissing me even before we'd reached the first landing, and once the bedroom door was closed, he quickly undid the buttons of my blouse. It obviously wasn't his first time. In fact, I'm pretty sure I wasn't the first girl he'd had on a works outing. Otherwise, how did he know about the special rates? I must confess, I hadn't expected it to be all over quite so quickly. Once he climbed off me, I disappeared into the bathroom while he sat on the end of the bed and lit up a fag. Perhaps it would be better the second time, I thought. But when I came back out, he was nowhere to be seen. I have to admit, I was disappointed. I might have felt more guilty about being unfaithful to Arthur if he hadn't been sick all over me on the journey back to Bristol. The next day, I told my mum what had happened, without letting on who the bloke was. After all, she hadn't met him, and was never likely to. Mum told me to keep my mouth shut, as she didn't want to have to cancel the wedding, and even if I did turn out to be pregnant, no one would be any the wiser, as Arthur and I would be married by the time anyone noticed.
Harry Clifton, 1920 to 1933. Chapter 1. I was told my father was killed in the war. Whenever I questioned my mother about his death, she didn't say any more than that he'd served with the Royal Gloucestershire Regiment and had been killed fighting on the Western Front only days before the peace treaty with Germany was signed. Grandma said my dad had been a brave man, and once, when we were alone in the house, she showed me his medals. My grandpa rarely offered an opinion on anything, but then he was deaf as a post, so he might not have heard the question in the first place. The only other man I can remember was my Uncle Stan, who used to sit at the top of the table at breakfast time. When he left of a morning, I would often follow him to the city docks where he worked. Every day I spent at the dockyard was an adventure. Cargo ships coming from distant lands and unloading their wares, rice, sugar, bananas, jute, and many other things I'd never heard of. Once the holds had been emptied, the dockers would load them with salt, apples, tin, even coal, my least favourite, because it was an obvious clue to what I'd been doing all day and annoyed my mother, before they set off again to I knew not where. I always wanted to help my Uncle Stan unload whatever ship had docked that morning, but he just laughed, saying, "All in good time, my lad." It couldn't be soon enough for me. But without any warning, school got in the way. I was sent to Merriwood Elementary when I was 6, and I thought it was a complete waste of time. What was the point of school when I could learn all I needed to at the docks? I wouldn't have bothered to go back the following day if my mother hadn't dragged me to the front gates, deposited me, and returned at 4 o'clock that afternoon to take me home. I didn't realize Mum had other plans for my future, which didn't include joining Uncle Stan in the shipyard. Once Mum had dropped me off each morning, I would hang around in the yard until she was out of sight, then slope off to the docks. I made sure I was always back at the school gates when she returned to pick me up in the afternoon. On the way home, I would tell her everything I'd done at school that day. I was good at making up stories, but it wasn't long before she discovered that was all they were, stories. One or two other boys from my school also used to hang around the docks, but I kept my distance from them. They were older and bigger and used to thump me if I got in their way. I also had to keep an eye out for Mr. Haskins, the chief ganger, because if he ever found me loitering, to use his favourite word, he would send me off with a kick up the backside and the threat, "If I see you loitering round here again, my lad, I'll report you to the headmaster." Occasionally, Haskins decided he'd seen me once too often, and I'd be reported to the headmaster, who would leather me before sending me back to my classroom. My form master, Mr. Holcomb, never let on if I didn't show up for his class, but then he was a bit soft. Whenever my mum found out I'd been playing truant, she couldn't hide her anger and would stop my halfpenny a week pocket money. But despite the occasional punch from an older boy, regular leatherings from the headmaster, and the loss of my pocket money, I still couldn't resist the draw of the docks. I made only one real friend while I loitered around the dockyard. His name was old Jack Tarr. Mr. Tarr lived in an abandoned railway carriage at the end of the sheds. Uncle Stan told me to keep away from old Jack because he was a stupid, dirty old tramp. He didn't look that dirty to me, certainly not as dirty as Stan, and it wasn't long before I discovered he wasn't stupid either. After lunch with my Uncle Stan, one bite of his Marmite sandwich, his discarded apple core, and a swig of beer, I would be back at school in time for a game of football, the only activity I considered it worth turning up for. After all, when I left school, I was going to captain Bristol City, or build a ship that would sail around the world. If Mr. Holcomb kept his mouth shut and the ganger didn't report me to the headmaster, I could go for days without being found out. And as long as I avoided the coal barges and was standing by the school gate at 4 o'clock every afternoon, my mother would never be any the wiser. Every other Saturday, Uncle Stan would take me to watch Bristol City at Ashton Gate. On Sunday mornings, Mum used to cart me off to Holy Nativity Church, something I couldn't find a way of getting out of. Once the Reverend Watts had given the final blessing, I would run all the way to the recreation ground and join my mates for a game of football before returning home in time for dinner. By the time I was 7, it was clear to anyone who knew anything about the game of football that I was never going to get into the school team, let alone Captain Bristol City. But that was when I discovered that God had given me one small gift, and it wasn't in my feet. To begin with, I didn't notice that anyone who sat near me in church on a Sunday morning stopped singing whenever I opened my mouth. I wouldn't have given it a second thought if Mum hadn't suggested I join the choir. I laughed scornfully. After all, everyone knew the choir was only for girls and sissies. I would have dismissed the idea out of hand if the Reverend Watts hadn't told me that choir boys were paid a penny for funerals and tuppence for weddings. My first experience of bribery. But even after I'd reluctantly agreed to take a vocal test, the devil decided to place an obstacle in my path, in the form of Miss Eleanor E. Munday. I would never have come across Miss Munday if she hadn't been the choir mistress at Holy Nativity. Although she was only 5'3" and looked as though a gust of wind might blow her away, no one tried to take the mickey. I have a feeling that even the devil would have been frightened of Miss Munday, because the Reverend Watts certainly was. I agreed to take a vocal test, but not before my mum had handed over a month's pocket money in advance. The following Sunday, I stood in line with a group of other lads and waited to be called. "You will always be on time for choir practice," Miss Munday announced, fixing a gimlet eye on me. I stared back defiantly. "You will never speak unless spoken to." I somehow managed to remain silent. "And during the service, you will concentrate at all times." I reluctantly nodded. And then, God bless her, she gave me a way out. "But most importantly," she declared, placing her hands on her hips, "within 12 weeks, you will be expected to pass a reading and writing test, so that I can be sure you are able to tackle a new anthem or an unfamiliar psalm." I was pleased to have fallen at the first hurdle, but as I was to discover, Miss Eleanor E. Munday didn't give up easily. "What piece have you chosen to sing, child?" she asked me when I reached the front of the line. "I haven't chosen anything," I told her. She opened a hymn book, handed it to me, and sat down at the piano. I smiled at the thought that I might still be able to make the second half of our Sunday morning football game. She began to play a familiar tune, and when I saw my mother glaring at me from the front row of pews, I decided I'd better go through with it, just to keep her happy. "All things bright and beautiful, all creatures great and small, all things wise and wonderful." A smile had appeared on Miss Munday's face long before I reached "The Lord God made them all." "What's your name, child?" she asked.
"Harry Clifton, miss."
"Harry Clifton, you will report for choir practice on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 6 o'clock sharp." Turning to the boy standing behind me, she said, "Next." I promised my mum I'd be on time for the first choir practice, even though I knew it would be my last, as Miss Munday would soon realize I couldn't read or write. And it would have been my last if it hadn't been obvious to anyone listening that my singing voice was in a different class to that of any other boy in the choir. In fact, The moment I opened my mouth, everyone fell silent, and the looks of admiration, even awe, that I had desperately sought on the football field, were happening in church. Miss Munday pretended not to notice. After she dismissed us, I didn't go home, but ran all the way to the docks so I could ask Mr. Tarr what I should do about the fact that I couldn't read or write. I listened carefully to the old man's advice, and the next day I went back to school and took my place in Mr. Holcomb's class. The schoolmaster couldn't hide his surprise when he saw me sitting in the front row, and was even more surprised when I paid close attention to the morning lesson for the first time. Mr. Holcomb began by teaching me the alphabet, and within days I could write out all 26 letters, if not always in the correct order. My mum would have helped me when I got home in the afternoon, but like the rest of my family, she also couldn't read or write. Uncle Stan could just about scrawl his signature, and although he could tell the difference between a packet of Wills's Star and Wild Woodbines, I was fairly sure he couldn't actually read the labels. Despite his unhelpful mutterings, I set about writing the alphabet on any piece of scrap paper I could find. Uncle Stan didn't seem to notice that the torn-up newspaper in the privy was always covered in letters. Once I'd mastered the alphabet, Mr. Holcomb introduced me to a few simple words: dog, cat, mum, and dad. That was when I first asked him about my dad, hoping that he might be able to tell me something about him. After all, he seemed to know everything. But he seemed puzzled that I knew so little about my own dad. A week later, he wrote my first four-letter word on the blackboard, book, and then five, house, and six, school. By the end of the month, I could write my first sentence: "The quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog," which, Mr. Holcomb pointed out, contained every letter in the alphabet. I checked, and he turned out to be right. By the end of term, I could spell anthem, psalm, and even hymn, although Mr. Holcomb kept reminding me I still dropped my H's whenever I spoke. But then we broke up for the holidays, and I began to worry I would never pass Miss Munday's demanding test without Mr. Holcomb's help. And that might have been the case if old Jack hadn't taken his place. I was half an hour early for choir practice on the Friday evening when I knew I would have to pass my second test if I hoped to continue as a member of the choir. I sat silently in the stalls, hoping Miss Munday would pick on someone else before she called on me. I had already passed the first test with what Miss Munday had described as flying colours. We had all been asked to recite the Lord's Prayer. This was not a problem for me, because for as long as I could remember, my mum knelt by my bed each night and repeated the familiar words before tucking me up. However, Miss Munday's next test was to prove far more demanding. By this time, the end of our second month, we were expected to read a psalm out loud in front of the rest of the choir. I chose Psalm 121, which I also knew off by heart, having sung it so often in the past. "I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help." I could only hope that my help cometh from the Lord. Although I was able to turn to the correct page in the psalm book, as I could now count from 1 to 100, I feared Miss Munday would realize that I was unable to follow every verse, line by line. If she did, she didn't let on, because I remained in the choir stalls for another month, while two other miscreants, her word, not that I knew what it meant until I asked Mr. Holcomb the next day, were dispatched back to the congregation. When the time came for me to take the third and final test, I was ready for it. Miss Munday asked those of us who remained to write out the Ten Commandments in the correct order without referring to the book of Exodus. The choir mistress turned a blind eye to the fact that I placed theft ahead of murder, couldn't spell adultery, and certainly didn't know what it meant. Only after two other miscreants were summarily dismissed for lesser offences did I realize just how exceptional my voice must be. On the first Sunday of Advent, Miss Monday announced that she had selected 3 new trebles, or little angels, as the Reverend Watts was wont to describe us, to join her choir, the remainder having been rejected for committing such unforgivable sins as chattering during the sermon, sucking a gobstopper, and, in the case of 2 boys, being caught playing conkers during the Nunc Dimittis. The following Sunday, I dressed up in a long blue cassock with a ruffled white collar. I alone was allowed to wear a bronze medallion of the Virgin Mother around my neck to show that I had been selected as the treble soloist. I would have proudly worn the medallion all the way back home, even to school the next morning to show off to the rest of the lads, if only Miss Monday hadn't retrieved it at the end of each service. On Sundays, I was transported into another world, but I feared this state of delirium could not last forever. Chapter 2. When Uncle Stan rose in the morning, he somehow managed to wake the entire household. No one complained, as he was the breadwinner in the family, and in any case he was cheaper and more reliable than an alarm clock. The first noise Harry would hear was the bedroom door slamming. This would be followed by his uncle tramping along the creaky wooden landing, down the stairs and out of the house. Then another door would slam as he disappeared into the privy. If anyone was still asleep, the rush of water as Uncle Stan pulled the chain, followed by 2 more slammed doors before he returned to the bedroom, served to remind them that Stan expected his breakfast to be on the table by the time he walked into the kitchen. He only had a wash and a shave on Saturday evenings before going off to the Palais or the Odeon. He took a bath 4 times a year on quarter day. No one was going to accuse Stan of wasting his hard-earned cash on soap. Maisie, Harry's mum, would be next up, leaping out of bed moments after the first slammed door. There would be a bowl of porridge on the stove by the time Stan came out of the privy. Grandma followed shortly afterwards and would join her daughter in the kitchen before Stan had taken his place at the head of the table. Harry had to be down within 5 minutes of the first slammed door if he hoped to get any breakfast. The last to arrive in the kitchen would be Grandpa, who was so deaf he often managed to sleep through Stan's early morning ritual. This daily routine in the Clifton household never varied. When you've only got 1 outside privy, 1 sink and 1 towel, order becomes a necessity. By the time Harry was splashing his face with a trickle of cold water, his mother would be serving breakfast in the kitchen, 2 thickly sliced pieces of bread covered in lard for Stan, and 4 thin slices for the rest of the family, which she would toast if there was any coal left in the sack dumped outside the front door every Monday. Once Stan had finished his porridge, Harry would be allowed to lick the bowl. A large brown pot of tea was always brewing on the hearth, which Grandma would pour into a variety of mugs through a silver-plated Victorian tea strainer she had inherited from her mother. While the other members of the family enjoyed a mug of unsweetened tea, sugar was only for high days and holidays, Stan would open his first bottle of beer, which he usually gulped down in 1 draught. He would then rise from the table and burp loudly before picking up his lunchbox, which Grandma had prepared while he was having his breakfast. 2 Marmite sandwiches, a sausage, an apple, 2 more bottles of beer, and a packet of 5 coffin nails. Once Stan had left for the docks, everyone began to talk at once. Grandma always wanted to know who had visited the tea shop where her daughter worked as a waitress, what they ate, what they were wearing, where they sat. Details of meals that were cooked on a stove in a room lit by electric light bulbs that didn't leave any candle wax, not to mention customers who sometimes left a threepenny bit tip, which Maisie had to split with the cook. Maisie was more concerned to find out what Harry had done at school the previous day. She demanded a daily report, which didn't seem to interest Grandma, perhaps because she'd never been to school. Come to think of it, she'd never been to a tea shop either. Grandpa rarely commented, because after 4 years of loading and unloading an artillery field gun, morning, noon and night, he was so deaf he had to satisfy himself with watching their lips move and nodding from time to time. This could give outsiders the impression he was stupid, which the rest of the family knew to their cost he wasn't. The family's morning routine only varied at weekends. On Saturdays, Harry would follow his uncle out of the kitchen, always remaining a pace behind him as he walked to the docks. On Sunday, Harry's mum would accompany the boy to Holy Nativity Church, where, from the third row of the pews, she would bask in the glory of the choir's treble soloist. But today was Saturday. During the 20-minute walk to the docks, Harry never opened his mouth unless his uncle spoke. Whenever he did, it invariably turned out to be the same conversation they'd had the previous Saturday. "When are you going to leave school and do a day's work, young'un?" was always Uncle Stan's opening salvo. "Not allowed to leave until I'm 14," Harry reminded him. "It's the law." "A bloody stupid law, if you ask me. I'd packed up school and was working on the docks by the time I was 12," Stan would announce, as if Harry had never heard this profound observation before. Harry didn't bother to respond, as he already knew what his uncle's next sentence would be. "And what's more, I'd signed up to join Kitchener's army before my 17th birthday." "Tell me about the war, Uncle Stan," said Harry, aware that this would keep him occupied for several hundred yards. "Me and your dad joined the Royal Gloucestershire Regiment on the same day," Stan said, touching his cloth cap as if saluting a distant memory. "After 12 weeks basic training at Taunton Barracks, we were shipped off to Wipers to fight the Boche. Once we got there, we spent most of our time cooped up in rat-infested trenches, waiting to be told by some toffee-nosed officer that when the bugle sounded, we was going over the top, bayonets fixed, rifles firing as we advanced towards the enemy lines." This would be followed by a long pause, after which Stan would add, "I was one of the lucky ones. Got back to Blighty all shipshape and Bristol fashion." Harry could have predicted his next sentence word for word, but remained silent. "You just don't know how lucky you are, my lad. I lost 2 brothers, your Uncle Ray and your Uncle Bert, and your father not only lost a brother, but his father, your other granddad, what you never met. A proper man, who could down a pint of beer faster than any docker I've ever come across." If Stan had looked down, he would have seen the boy mouthing his words. But today, to Harry's surprise, Uncle Stan added a sentence he'd never uttered before. "And your dad would still be alive today if only management had listened to me." Harry was suddenly alert. His dad's death had always been the subject of whispered conversations and hushed tones, but Uncle Stan clammed up, as if he realized he'd gone too far. "Maybe next week," thought Harry, catching his uncle up and keeping in step with him as if they were 2 soldiers on a parade ground. "So, who are City playing this afternoon?" asked Stan, back on script. "Charlton Athletic," Harry replied. "They're a load of old cobblers." "They trounced us last season," Harry reminded his uncle. "Bloody lucky, if you ask me," said Stan, and didn't open his mouth again. When they reached the entrance to the dockyard, Stan clocked in before heading off to the pen where he was working with a gang of other dockers, none of whom could afford to be a minute late. Unemployment was at an all-time high, and too many young men were standing outside the gates waiting to take their place. Harry didn't follow his uncle, because he knew that if Mr. Haskins caught him hanging around the sheds, he would get a clip round the ear, followed by a boot up the backside from his uncle for annoying the ganger. Instead, he set off in the opposite direction. Harry's first port of call every Saturday morning was old Jack Tarr, who lived in the railway carriage at the other end of the dockyard. He had never told Stan about his regular visits because his uncle had warned him to avoid the old man at all costs. "Probably hasn't had a bath in years," said a man who washed once a quarter, and then only after Harry's mother complained about the smell. But curiosity had long ago got the better of Harry, and one morning he'd crept up to the railway carriage on his hands and knees, lifted himself up, and peeped through a window. The old man was sitting in first class, reading a book. Old Jack turned to face him and said, "Come on in, lad." Harry jumped down and didn't stop running until he reached his front door. The following Saturday, Harry once again crawled up to the carriage and peered inside. Old Jack seemed to be fast asleep, but then Harry heard him say, "Why don't you come in, my boy? I'm not going to bite you." Harry turned the heavy brass handle and tentatively pulled open the carriage door, but he didn't step inside. He just stared at the man seated in the centre of the carriage. It was hard to tell how old he was, because his face was covered in a well-groomed salt-and-pepper beard, which made him look like the sailor on the Players Please packet. But he looked at Harry with a warmth in his eyes that Uncle Stan had never managed. "Are you old Jack Tar?" Harry ventured. "That's what they call me," the old man replied. "Is this where you live?" Harry asked, glancing around the carriage, his eyes settling on a stack of old newspapers piled high on the opposite seat. "Yes," he replied. "It's been my home for these past 20 years. Why don't you close the door and take a seat, young man?" Harry gave the offer some thought before he jumped back out of the carriage and once again ran away. The following Saturday, Harry did close the door, but he kept hold of the handle, ready to bolt if the old man as much as twitched a muscle. They stared at each other for some time before old Jack asked, "What's your name?"
"Harry."
"And where do you go to school?"
"I don't go to school."
"Then what are you hoping to do with your life, young man?"
"Join my uncle on the docks, of course," Harry replied.
"Why would you want to do that?" said the old man.
"Why not?" Harry bristled. "Don't you think I'm good enough?"
"You're far too good," replied old Jack. "When I was your age," he continued, "I wanted to join the army, and nothing my old man could say or do would dissuade me." For the next hour, Harry stood mesmerized, while old Jack Tar reminisced about the docks, the city of Bristol, and lands beyond the sea that he couldn't have been taught about in geography lessons. The following Saturday, and for more Saturdays than he would remember, Harry continued to visit old Jack Tar. But he never once told his uncle or his mother, for fear they would stop him going to see his first real friend. When Harry knocked on the door of the railway carriage that Saturday morning, old Jack had clearly been waiting for him, because his usual Cox's orange pippin had been placed on the seat opposite. Harry picked it up, took a bite, and sat down.
"Thank you, Mr. Tar," Harry said as he wiped some juice from his chin. He never asked where the apples came from. It just added to the mystery of the great man.
How different he was from Uncle Stan, who repeated the little he knew again and again, whereas old Jack introduced Harry to new words, new experiences, even new worlds, every week. He often wondered why Mr. Tar wasn't a schoolmaster. He seemed to know even more than Miss Munday, and almost as much as Mr. Holcombe. Harry was convinced that Mr. Holcombe knew everything, because he never failed to answer any question Harry put to him. Old Jack smiled across at him, but didn't speak until Harry had finished his apple and thrown the core out of the window. "What have you learnt at school this week?" the old man asked, "that you didn't know a week ago?"
"Mr. Holcombe told me there are other countries beyond the sea that are part of the British Empire, and they are all reigned over by the king."
"He's quite right," said old Jack. "Can you name any of those countries?"
"Australia, Canada, India," he hesitated, "and America."
"No, not America," said old Jack. "That used to be the case, but it isn't any more, thanks to a weak prime minister and a sick king."
"Who was the king, and who was the prime minister?"
demanded Harry angrily. "King George the Third was on the throne in 1776, said old Jack, but to be fair, he was a sick man, while Lord North, his Prime Minister, simply ignored what was taking place in the colonies, and sadly, in the end, our own kith and kin took up arms against us. But we must have beaten them, said Harry. No, we didn't, said old Jack. Not only did they have right on their side, not that that's a prerequisite for victory. What does prerequisite mean? Required as a precondition, said old Jack, who then continued as if he hadn't been interrupted. But they were also led by a brilliant general. What was his name? George Washington. You told me last week that Washington was the capital of America. Was he named after the city? No, the city was named after him. It was built on an area of marshland known as Columbia, through which the Potomac River flows. Is Bristol named after a man, too? No, chuckled old Jack, amused by how quickly Harry's inquisitive mind could switch from subject to subject. Bristol was originally called Brigstow, which means the site of a bridge. So when did it become Bristol? Historians differ in their opinions, said old Jack, although Bristol Castle was built by Robert of Gloucester in 1109, when he saw the opportunity to trade wool with the Irish. After that, the city developed into a trading port. Since then, it's been a centre of shipbuilding for hundreds of years, and grew even more quickly when the Navy needed to expand in 1914. My dad fought in the Great War, said Harry with pride. Did you? For the first time, old Jack hesitated before answering one of Harry's questions. He just sat there, not saying a word. I'm sorry, Mr. Tarr, said Harry. I didn't mean to pry. No, no, said old Jack. It's just that I haven't been asked that question for some years. Without another word, he opened his hand to reveal a sixpence. Harry took the little silver coin and bit it, something he'd seen his uncle do. Thank you, he said before pocketing it. Go and buy yourself some fish and chips from the Dockside Cafe, but don't tell your uncle, because he'll only ask where you got the money. In truth, Harry had never told his uncle anything about old Jack. He'd once heard Stan tell his mum, a loony ought to be locked up. He'd asked Miss Munday what a loony was, because he couldn't find the word in the dictionary, and when she told him, he realized for the first time just how stupid his Uncle Stan must be. Not necessarily stupid, Miss Munday counseled, simply ill-informed and therefore prejudiced. I have no doubt, Harry, she added, that you'll meet many more such men during your lifetime, some of them in far more exalted positions than your uncle. Chapter 3 Maisie waited until she heard the front door slam and was confident that Stan was on his way to work before she announced, I've been offered a job as a waitress at the Royal Hotel. No one seated round the table responded, as conversations at breakfast were supposed to follow a regular pattern and not take anyone by surprise. Harry had a dozen questions he wanted to ask, but waited for his grandma to speak first. She simply busied herself with pouring another cup of tea, as if she hadn't heard her daughter in the first place. "Will someone please say something?" said Maisie. "I didn't even realize you were looking for another job," ventured Harry. "I wasn't," said Maisie. But last week, a Mr. Frampton, the manager of the Royal, dropped into Tilly's for coffee. He came back several times, and then he offered me a job. I thought you were happy at the tea shop, said Grandma, finally joining in. After all, Miss Tilly pays well in the hour's suit. I am happy, said Harry's mum, but Mr. Frampton's offering me £5 a week, and half of all the tips. I could be bringing home as much as £6 on a Friday. Grandma sat there with her mouth wide open. "Will you have to work nights?" asked Harry, once he'd finished licking Stan's porridge bowl. "No, I won't," Maisie said, ruffling her son's hair. "And what's more, I'll get one day off a fortnight." "Are your clothes posh enough for a grand hotel like the Royal?" asked Grandma. "I'll be supplied with a uniform and a fresh white apron every morning. The hotel even has its own laundry." "I don't doubt it," said Grandma. "But I can think of one problem we're all going to have to learn to live with." "And what's that, Mum?" asked Maisie. "You could end up earning more than Stan, and he's not going to like that, not one little bit."
"Then he'll just have to learn to live with it, won't he?"
said Grandpa, offering an opinion for the first time in weeks. The extra money was going to come in useful, especially after what had happened at the Holy Nativity. Maisie had been about to leave the church after the service when Miss Munday walked purposefully down the aisle towards her. "Can I have a private word with you, Mrs. Clifton?" she asked, before turning and walking back down the aisle towards the vestry. Maisie chased after her like a child in the Pied Piper's wake. She feared the worst. What had Harry been up to this time? Maisie followed the choir mistress into the vestry and felt her legs give way when she saw the Reverend Watts, Mr. Holcomb, and another gentleman standing there. As Miss Munday closed the door quietly behind her, Maisie began to shake uncontrollably. The Reverend Watts placed an arm around her shoulder. "There's nothing for you to worry about, my dear," he assured her. "On the contrary, I hope you will feel we are the bearers of glad tidings," he added, offering her a seat. Maisie sat down, but still couldn't stop shaking. Once everyone was seated, Miss Munday took over. "We wanted to talk to you about Harry, Mrs. Clifton," she began. Maisie pursed her lips. What could the boy possibly have done to bring three such important people together? "I'll not beat about the bush," the choir mistress continued. "The music master at St. Bede's has approached me and asked if Harry would consider entering his name for one of their choral scholarships." "But he's very happy at Holy Nativity," said Maisie. "In any case, where is St. Bede's Church? I've never even heard of it." "St. Bede's is not a church," said Miss Munday. "It's a choir school that supplies choristers for St. Mary Redcliffe, which was famously described by Queen Elizabeth as the fairest and godliest church in all the land." "So would he have to leave his school as well as the church?" asked Maisie in disbelief. "Try to look upon it as an opportunity that might change his whole life, Mrs. Clifton," said Mr. Holcomb, speaking for the first time. "But wouldn't he have to mix with posh, clever boys?" "I doubt if there will be many children at St. Bede's cleverer than Harry," said Mr. Holcomb. "He's the brightest lad I've ever taught. Although we get the occasional boy into the grammar school, none of our pupils has ever been offered the chance of a place at St. Bede's before." "There's something else you need to know before you make up your mind," said the Reverend Watts. Maisie looked even more anxious. "Harry would have to leave home during term time, because St. Bede's is a boarding school." "Then it's out of the question," said Maisie. "I couldn't afford it." "That shouldn't prove a problem," said Miss Munday. "If Harry is offered a scholarship, the school would not only waive any fees, but also award him a bursary of £10 a term." "But is this one of those schools where the fathers wear suits and ties and the mothers don't work?" asked Maisie. "It's worse than that," said Miss Munday, trying to make light of it. "The masters wear long black gowns and mortarboards on their heads." "Still," said the Reverend Watts, joining in, "at least there would be no more leatherings for Harry. They're far more refined at St. Bede's. They just cane the boys." Only Maisie didn't laugh. "But why would he want to leave home?" she asked. "He's settled at Merriwood Elementary, and he won't want to give up being senior chorister at Holy Nativity." "I must confess that my loss would be even greater than his," said Miss Munday. "But then, I'm sure our Lord would not want me to stand in the way of such a gifted child.
simply because of my own selfish desires," she added quietly. "Even if I agree," said Maisie, playing her last card, "that doesn't mean Harry will."
"I had a word with the boy last week," admitted Mr. Holcombe. "Of course, he was apprehensive about such a challenge, but if I recall, his exact words were, 'I'd like to have a go, sir, but only if you think I'm good enough.' But," he added before Maisie could respond, "he also made it clear that he wouldn't even consider the idea unless his mother agreed."
Harry was both terrified and excited by the thought of taking the entrance exam, but just as anxious about failing and letting so many people down as he was about succeeding and having to leave home. During the following term, he never once missed a lesson at Merriwood, and when he returned home each evening, he went straight up to the bedroom he shared with Uncle Stan, where, with the aid of a candle, he studied for hours that until then he hadn't realized existed. There were even occasions when his mother found Harry sound asleep on the floor, open books scattered around him. Every Saturday morning he continued to visit old Jack, who seemed to know a great deal about St. Bede's, and continued to teach Harry about so many other things, almost as if he knew where Mr. Holcombe had left off. On Saturday afternoons, much to the disgust of Uncle Stan, Harry no longer accompanied him to Ashton Gate to watch Bristol City, but returned to Merriwood, where Mr. Holcombe gave him extra lessons. It would be years before Harry worked out that Mr. Holcombe was also foregoing his regular visits to support the Robins in order to teach him. As the day of the examination drew nearer, Harry became even more frightened of failure than of the possibility of success. On the appointed day, Mr. Holcombe accompanied his star pupil to the Colston Hall, where the 2-hour examination would take place. He left Harry at the entrance to the building with the words, "Don't forget to read each question twice before you even pick up your pen," a piece of advice he'd repeated several times during the past week. Harry smiled nervously and shook hands with Mr. Holcombe as if they were old friends. He entered the examination hall to find about 60 other boys standing around in small groups chattering. It was clear to Harry that many of them already knew each other, while he didn't know anyone. Despite this, one or two of them stopped talking and glanced at him as he made his way to the front of the hall, trying to look confident. "Abbott, Barrington, Cabot, Clifton, Deakins, Fry." Harry took his place at a desk in the front row, and just moments before the clock struck 10, several masters in long black gowns and mortarboards swept in and placed examination papers on the desks in front of each candidate. "Gentlemen," said a master standing at the front of the hall, who had not taken part in the distribution of the papers, "my name is Mr. Frobisher, and I am your invigilator. You have 2 hours in which to answer 100 questions. Good luck." A clock he couldn't see struck 10. All around him, pens dipped into inkwells and began to scratch furiously across paper. But Harry simply folded his arms, leant on the desk, and read each question slowly. He was among the last to pick up his pen. Harry couldn't know that Mr. Holcombe was pacing up and down on the pavement outside, feeling far more nervous than his pupil, or that his mother was glancing up at the clock in the foyer of the Royal Hotel every few minutes as she served morning coffee, or that Miss Munday was kneeling in silent prayer before the altar at Holy Nativity. Moments after the clock had struck 12, the examination papers were gathered up and the boys were allowed to leave the hall, some laughing, some frowning, others thoughtful. When Mr. Holcombe first saw Harry, his heart sank. "Was it that bad?" he asked. Harry didn't reply until he was certain no other boy could overhear his words. "Not at all what I expected,"
he said. "What do you mean?" asked Mr. Holcombe anxiously.
"The questions were far too easy," replied Harry.
Mr. Holcombe felt that he had never been paid a greater compliment in his life.
"Two suits, madam, grey. One blazer, navy. 5 shirts, white. 5 stiff collars, white. 6 pairs of calf-length socks, grey. 6 sets of undergarments, white. And 1 St. Bede's tie."
The shop assistant checked the list carefully.
"I think that covers everything. Oh, no, the boy will also need a school cap."
He reached under the counter, opened a drawer, and removed a red and black cap, which he placed on Harry's head.
"A perfect fit," he pronounced.
Maisie smiled at her son with considerable pride. Harry looked every inch a St. Bede's boy.
"That will be £3.10 and 6, madam."
Maisie tried not to look too dismayed.
"Is it possible to purchase any of these items second-hand?" she whispered. "No, madam, this is not a second-hand shop," said the assistant,
who had already decided that this customer would not be allowed to open an account. Maisie opened her purse, handed over 4-pound notes, and waited for the change. She was relieved that St. Bede's had paid the first term's bursary in advance, especially as she still needed to buy 2 pairs of leather shoes, black with laces, 2 pairs of gym shoes, white with laces, and 1 pair of slippers, bedroom. The assistant coughed.
"The boy will also need 2 pairs of pyjamas and a dressing gown."
Yes, of course," said Maisie, hoping she had enough money left in her purse to cover the cost.
"And am I to understand that the boy is a choral scholar?" asked the assistant, looking more closely at his list.
"Yes, he is," Maisie replied proudly.
"Then he'll also require 1 cassock red, 2 surplices white, and a St. Bede's medallion."
Maisie wanted to run out of the shop.
"Those items will be supplied by the school when he attends his first choir practice," the assistant added before handing over her change. "Will you be requiring anything else, madam?"
"No, thank you," said Harry, who picked up the 2 bags, grabbed his mother by the arm, and led her quickly out of T.C. Marsh, Tailors of Distinction.
Harry spent the Saturday morning before he was due to report to St. Bede's with old Jack.
"Are you nervous about going to a new school?" asked old Jack.
"No, I'm not," said Harry defiantly.
Old Jack smiled.
"I'm terrified," he admitted.
"So is every new bug, as you'll be called. Try to treat the whole thing as if you're starting out on an adventure to a new world, where everyone begins as equals. But the moment they hear me speak, they'll realize I'm not their equal."
"Possibly. But the moment they hear you sing, they'll realize they're not your equal."
"Most of them will have come from rich families with servants."
"That will only be a consolation for the more stupid ones," said old Jack.
"And some of them will have brothers at the school, and even fathers and grandfathers who were there before them."
"Your father was a fine man," said old Jack. "And none of them will have a better mother, of that I can assure you."
"You knew my father?" said Harry, unable to mask his surprise.
"Knew would be an exaggeration," said old Jack. "But I observed him from afar, as I have many others who have worked at the docks. He was a decent, courageous, God-fearing man."
"But do you know how he died?" asked Harry, looking old Jack in the eye, hoping he would at last get an honest reply to the question that had troubled him for so long.
"What have you been told?" asked old Jack cautiously.
"That he was killed in the Great War. But as I was born in 1920, even I can work out that that can't be possible."
Old Jack didn't speak for some time. Harry remained on the edge of his seat.
"He was certainly badly wounded in the war, but you're right. That was not the cause of his death."
"Then how did he die?" asked Harry.
"If I knew, I'd tell you," replied old Jack. "But there were so many rumours flying around at the time that I wasn't sure who to believe. However, there are several men, and three in particular, who undoubtedly know the truth about what happened that night.
My Uncle Stan must be one of them, said Harry, but who are the other two?
Old Jack hesitated before he replied. Phil Haskins and Mr. Hugo.
Mr. Haskins, the ganger, said Harry. He wouldn't give me the time of day. And who's Mr. Hugo?
Hugo Barrington, the son of Sir Walter Barrington.
The family who owned the shipping line?
The same, replied old Jack, fearing he'd gone too far.
And are they also decent, courageous, God-fearing men?
Sir Walter is among the finest men I have ever known.
But what about his son, Mr. Hugo?
Not cut from the same cloth, I fear, said old Jack, without further explanation.
Chapter 4. The smartly dressed boy sat next to his mother on the back seat of the tram.
This is our stop, she said, when the tram came to a halt.
They got off and began to walk slowly up the hill towards the school, going a little slower with each step. Harry held on to his mother with one hand while he clutched a battered suitcase with the other. Neither of them spoke as they watched several hansom cabs, as well as the occasional chauffeur-driven car, pull up outside the front gates of the school. Fathers were shaking hands with their sons, while fur-draped mothers embraced their offspring before giving them a peck on the cheek, like a bird finally having to acknowledge her fledglings were about to fly the nest. Harry didn't want his mother to kiss him in front of the other boys, so he let go of her hand when they were still 50 yards from the gate. Maisie, sensing his discomfort, bent down and kissed him quickly on the forehead.
Good luck, Harry. Make us all proud of you.
Goodbye, Mum, he said,
fighting back the tears. Maisie turned and began to walk back down the hill, tears flooding down her own cheeks. Harry walked on, recalling his uncle's description of going over the top at Ypres before charging towards the enemy lines. Never look back, or you're a dead man. Harry wanted to look back, but he knew if he did, he would not stop running until he was safely on the tram. He gritted his teeth and kept on walking.
Did you have a good hauls, old chap? One of the boys was asking a friend.
Topping, the other replied. The pater took me to Lord's for the varsity match.
Was Lord's a church? Harry wondered. And if so, what sort of match could possibly take place in a church?
He marched resolutely on through the school gates, coming to a halt when he recognized a man standing by the front door of the school holding a clipboard.
"And who are you, young man?" he asked, giving Harry a welcoming smile.
"Harry Clifton, sir," he replied, removing his cap just as Mr. Holcomb had instructed him to do whenever a master or a lady spoke to him.
"Clifton," he said, running a finger down a long list of names. "Ah, yes." He placed a tick by Harry's name. "First-generation choral scholar. Many congratulations, and welcome to St. Bede's. I'm Mr. Frobisher, your housemaster, and this is Frobisher House. If you leave your suitcase in the hall, a prefect will accompany you to the refectory, where I'll be addressing all the new boys before supper."
Harry had never had supper before. Tea was always the last meal in the Clifton household, before being sent to bed the moment it was dark. Electricity hadn't yet reached Stillhouse Lane, and there was rarely enough money over to spend on candles.
"Thank you, sir," said Harry,
before making his way through the front door and into a large, highly polished wood-panelled hall. He put his case down and stared up at a painting of an old man with grey hair and bushy white sideburns, dressed in a long black gown with a red hood draped around his shoulders.
"What's your name?"
barked a voice from behind him.
"Clifton, sir," said Harry, turning to see a tall boy wearing long trousers.
"You don't call me Sir Clifton. You call me Fisher. I'm a prefect, not a master."
Sorry, sir, said Harry.
Leave your case over there and follow me. Harry placed his second-hand, battered suitcase next to a row of leather trunks. His was the only one that didn't have a set of initials stamped on it. He followed the prefect down a long corridor that was lined with photographs of old-school teams and display cabinets filled with silver cups to remind the next generation of past glories. When they reached the refectory, Fisher said, "You can sit anywhere you like, Clifton. Just be sure to stop talking the moment Mr. Frobisher enters the refectory." Harry hesitated for some time before deciding which of the four long tables he would sit at. A number of boys were already milling around in clusters, talking quietly. Harry walked slowly to the far corner of the room and took a place at the end of the table. He looked up to see several boys pouring into the hall, looking just as perplexed as he felt. One of them came and sat next to Harry, while another sat opposite him. They continued chatting to each other as if he wasn't there. Without warning, a bell rang, and everyone stopped talking as Mr. Frobisher entered the refectory. He took his place behind a lectern Harry hadn't noticed, and tugged at the lapels of his gown. "Welcome," he began, doffing his mortarboard to the assembled gathering. "On this, the first day of your first term at St. Bede's. In a few moments' time, you will experience your first school meal, and I can promise you that it doesn't get any better." One or two of the boys laughed nervously. "Once you have finished supper, you will be taken up to your dormitories where you will unpack. At 8 o'clock, you will hear another bell. Actually, it's the same bell, just being rung at a different time." Harry smiled, although most of the boys hadn't caught Mr. Frobisher's little joke. 30 minutes later, the same bell will ring again, and you will then go to bed, but not before you've washed and brushed your teeth. You will then have 30 minutes to read before lights out, after which you will go to sleep. Any child caught talking after lights out will be punished by the duty prefect. You will not hear another bell, continued Mr. Frobisher, until 6:30 tomorrow morning, when you will rise, wash and dress in time to report back to the refectory before 7. Any child who is late will forego his breakfast. Morning assembly will be held at 8 o'clock in the Great Hall, where the headmaster will address us. This will be followed by your first lesson at 8:30. There will be 3 60-minute lessons during the morning, with 10-minute breaks between them, giving you time to change classrooms. This will be followed by lunch at 12. In the afternoon, there will only be